along with Andrea Carnes and Michael Opping, two of our curators. This was written 10 years ago and is still, I think, really a vital resource for us in learning more about our permanent collection. And of course, marking the 10-year anniversary and celebration of these 10 years in this building, we've acquired 9 new pieces and one temporary piece. And Mark's going to talk a little bit about one or two of those on this talk. Mark earned his BA with honors in art and MA in art from the University of California, Santa Barbara in 1970 and 72, respectively. He's a professor. Oh, I almost forgot the most important degree. He earned his PhD in the history of art from the University of Pennsylvania in 1977. He's a professor and holder of the Kay and Velma Chair of Art History at TCU, where he began teaching in 1977. He is a prolific writer and has authored myriad books, essays, and exhibition catalogs. He's taught several college courses, more than several, many college courses, using the modern as a touchstone, and our collection and special exhibitions as a way to integrate the study of art history with actual looking at works of art, which is so important. His knowledge of the museum and its holdings is vast, and I've heard that the classes that he teaches here really give great insight to his students. I think that we will all leave this tour with new knowledge and feel lucky to have been on the tour. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you and get started.
Thanks. Hold your applause, please. Can you hear me okay? I've got allergies a bit, so I'll try to speak up. It's a pleasure to be here. Just one small correction. Although I'm on very close terms with Kay and Velma, it's Kimball is their last name. I want to make sure that that gets out there. I've actually had letters addressed to me, Dr. Mark Thistlewaite, Dr. Kay Kimball, Dr. Velma Kimball, and so forth. But it is the Kimball Chair, just for clarification. As Aaron said, the idea was thinking about 10 years in this new building, which is hard to believe it's 10 years on the one hand. On the other hand, it seems like a long time. But it gave me sort of pause for thought, too, about how long I've been involved with the museum itself. And it's been such a part of my teaching and my scholarly activity. It's really quite remarkable, so I'm honored and pleased to speak to you today. I realize I was appointed to the Board of Trustees in 1983 as a one-year term. Don't tell anybody that on the board. I'm still on it. I had the privilege of teaching a course in this building for us the semester after it opened. And as Aaron mentioned, I've done a lot of courses. I'm doing one now at the Carter, but I've done a lot of courses in the museums. It's the only course, and it's still true, the only course where after the very first meeting, the students were so stunned by this building that two-thirds of the class signed up to be members of the museum. And it was a real testament, I think, to the building. I was fortunate to be one of the two external advisory committee members to the building committee, the other being Ted Pillsbury, and got to see the process, which was really a very, I thought, very well-managed process, looking at dozens of architects that might be possible, and then deciding on the final six and hearing the final six make their presentations. And in thinking about that, I went back and looked at my notebook from that experience, and I noticed that I had written next to Ando's name a big star, and put beautiful building, big spaces, and then I put, but not too overwhelming. And I think that's pretty much held true. I think it's a building that is very grand, but one still feels very comfortable in it. I've been in some buildings that have very large galleries and spaces, and they're not comfortable. This, on the other hand, works really well. So what I wanted to do today was to walk you through a couple of galleries, actually. We don't have a lot. I was a little disappointed that the whole collection was available, but the more I thought about it, there are too many things to talk about. And so it's nice to have kind of limitations. And this will be, in some ways, more anecdotal than perhaps a normal talk that I might give, just because this museum has meant so much to me, and I've been lucky to be involved in it. If you have any questions as we're going through, don't hesitate to ask. I'll be glad to try to answer them. Let's go in. We're going to go into the gallery that has the Mark Bradford piece, a new piece. And as we're walking, let's walk. We're walking. I still think this is such a great entry, and I'm always taken aback by looking out to my right to see the water and all those rectilinear elements, but then this wonderful oval shape, this curving wall that I still remember the first time I walked in and saw that, and I thought, that's kind of odd. And then to come around and see that gallery with the Kiefer book with wings in it, I think it's still a remarkable experience, and it's Michael Opping did a terrific job of finding a piece that just really works well within that space. I'm not going to say anything about it. Just take a look. I do too. Kind of what's nice too is how the slit matches the wood, so it creates a gulf.
It becomes two pieces in a way that
it... Yeah. It's nice to see this Andre in here. I don't think it ever has been in here before. And it's always nice to see a work in a different place and how it works within a museum, or if you see an exhibition in one venue and then you see it here, how it changes the way you see things. I remember a couple of years ago we were out in Los Angeles and there was a Richard Tuttle exhibition. Terry's heard this story, I think, because she knows Tuttle is not my favorite artist, but he's gone up in my estimation. And in part it was when we were it was LA MoCA and we were looking at the show, and I really thought, this is really terrific work. And I was familiar with the piece in the collection here. I'm pointing like it's there. It's not, but it usually is. And I came around and I saw a piece, and I said to Randy, I said, now the Modern should have something like this. And it was the Modern's piece. And, you know, talk about feeling the fool. But it was, the context was so entirely different. And it was one of these things that really kind of reminds you how much art viewing is premised on the context, as much as your expectations. And the knowledge that you bring to it, and the intuition you have. I mean, there's so many factors that go in. I really like this here. I like the way that the slit sort of blends in with the wood and creates these two kind of separate pieces with more of the sense maybe of like the river or whatever, however you want to read it, but just also kind of floating of those forms. And it really changes the way you think about it, because we've been so used to seeing it on a east-west kind of presentation. To see it more laterally, perhaps, is also opens up a different way of thinking about it. And I'll be curious to see how people, whether they will walk on it or they'll read it as a barrier like you all, and sort of stand on either side of it in this spot. I wanted to say a few words about the Mark Bradford piece. I'm not all that familiar with it, but I do know something about it. And it's a work that I'm really very much intrigued with. If you want to sit down, go ahead. This is a work called Kingdom Day, and it's from 2010. It originally was shown in Seoul, Korea, in an exhibition. And when it was there, it was a single work. And apparently after it got returned, I don't know the history of it, how it got changed or when exactly, but obviously after that viewing and at some point before it came here, Bradford decided to cut it into four equal sections, which changes the sort of panoramic, procession-like quality of it, perhaps, and gives you a different sensibility. The title, Kingdom Day, refers to an annual parade that takes place in Los Angeles. It has since 1986. And it's a parade that's in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. It occurs on or around that national holiday. It actually started in San Diego a few years earlier than that, and then the person who had begun it was based in L.A. So since 86, it's been in Los Angeles. And in this particular work, Bradford has indicated that he was really thinking of the parade that occurred in 1992, which was a year after the Rodney King beating, actually half a year after that 1991 beating. And the impact that it had on the city, his family, his mother in particular, owned a hair salon. In fact, he, as a young man, worked in that hair salon. And he talked about the impact of the riots that resulted in the aftermath of the beating, and also the curfew that went into effect, how businesses were told in South Central LA to close at 6 p.m. And he said many of their customers couldn't get there until 6 p.m. And so he said a lot of the neighborhood businesses would actually put up blinds or shutters and still operate, but looking like it was dark. And he talked about it, he used a wonderful phrase, an invisible economy was taking place at that time. And these patches of dark, I think, sort of remind you of that. It has a map-like quality, and one thing Bradford has indicated consistently is that he's very much taken with the idea of mapping. He wants to be communally or involved with his community, I should say, in terms of knowing location and place as well as space, but also on a larger scale as well. And in a very real sense, I think you can read this on one level as a kind of mapping of LA. And all the bits and pieces that go into it, and it's built up of layers and layers and layers of printed material that he picks up on the streets in the South Central community. And in this case, material that related to Rodney King, that beating and the aftermath of it. And he pastes those together. He uses twine of various thicknesses for the linear elements, curvilinear elements. And then he'll sand and he'll rework and he'll sand, something Vernon Fisher did in a lot of his early work as well with letter forms. But he will really work the surface. It's a collage-like surface made of printed material, but then in essence he kind of decollages it. And he works back through layers. He's talked about his fondness for the idea of the palimpsest set, the idea of layering of a palimpsest is writing that is under other writing. You'll find it going back to medieval books, manuscripts, where somebody will write something in the margins and then a century later somebody will come along and rub it out and write over it. But you can still see the sort of ghost writing. And he likes that idea, the layering is so important to him. And he talks about layering also in terms of social information. And that would relate, I think, to Rodney King and Martin Luther King Jr. And putting it together with the modern grid. The grid in modernist art has loomed large as a kind of controlling form, and a form that addresses the flatness of the surface of whatever the format is, particularly painting and anything on paper. And a good example of the modernist grid right now is the Agnes Martin work, which is in the Farr Gallery. And what he's doing is partly taking that notion of the kind of order and balance that grid has, and putting this social information in abutting it with it, in a sense, or juxtaposing it with it, to give this very broken kind of grid, very dynamic, and in a way very reflective of Los Angeles, as we might just think of Los Angeles as a very dynamic place. He's used global, but also Google satellite imagery of parts of Los Angeles in creating this. He's also used images that he had of helicopter surveillance footage that was shown during the riots in 91. So that all feeds into this. So there's literally a lot going on in this work. I mean, it's something you can really get lost in. And the way that it's now configured, in a way, you really do become part of it. Something that the abstract expressionists talked about of sort of engulfing you in their painting. In a sense, it really becomes quite real here. And I mentioned how, as a single piece, it has maybe a sort of processional quality in a very vague way, like a parade. Separated, it almost takes a kind of, I mean, it makes a sort of map aspect, I think, a little more present. And also maybe the idea of surveillance, that these are huge monitors, for example, and in a kind of room where you're looking at what's going on in the city. But it really becomes this incredible network of forms. And, you know, I'm sure most of you have flown at night and looked out on a big city, and there's a sensibility here, I think, that you recognize as well. It's part of a series of works that he's done that are similar to this. He's done paintings that have dealt with an area, Baldwin Hills in Los Angeles, that a lot of wealthy blacks traditionally have lived in, and he's mapped that in somewhat similar way, the black having a connotation of the African Americans. Here, perhaps, you could relate it to the curfew idea and so forth. It's really a wonderful work. And also this band at the bottom, again, it's, I don't want to direct your reading too much, but for me, it is reminiscent without at all resembling the idea that the Pacific Ocean is right there at the edge of Los Angeles as well. So there's a lot, as I say, going on in the work. And it's clearly a work that does come out of abstract expressionism. Somebody like Pollock in particular comes out of interest in collage, which is one of the great inventions, artistic inventions of the 20th century, early 20th century, and then puts a very contemporary presentation to it. It's really quite remarkable. Okay, any questions before we go? Yes. The artist would have decided, yeah.
And you don't know the reason.
No. Wait. Yeah, she wanted to know who decided that it should be in panels rather than as a singular piece. Okay, let's go. Speaking of collage, just take a look at the Rauschenberg work here, because collage is going to be somewhat of a theme. As we'll see. And then I want to walk over to the Viglay work. If you all would, just like a class, move in, stop. I wanted to talk about this work. It's a work that has always intrigued me, although I haven't probably paid as much attention to it as I should have. It's by Jacques Viglay. A French artist. It's a work that in many ways is like Bradford's work and sets a sort of precedent for Bradford's work, in that it's layers upon layers of advertising posters that he has pulled off, literally ripped off of sides of walls and posting hoardings and so forth in Paris. The title is the Rue de Tolbiac, and then it continues with the phrase that you see here, c'est normal, or c'est normand. It's normal, it's Normand, referring to Normandy, the area of Brittany in France, where he's actually from originally, although the Rue de Tolbiac is in Paris in the 13th arrondissement in the southeast part of Paris. He did a number of works actually in the early 60s, which is, this is dates from 62, as I think, yeah, that have that title within it. Most of his works carry titles of the site of the origin of the piece itself. And in some ways, I didn't mention this with Bradford, I meant to. Bradford has referred to himself as a flaneur, which is a French term for typically a male who just simply walks through the street looking at things in a kind of casual way without any sort of agenda. And Vielgaille, in some ways, is very much like that as well, seeing what he sees, drawn to these posters, which are typically in the state that you see here. In most of his work, not all, but in most of his work, what he's taken off the sides of buildings and walls and so forth are presented as they were when they were on those. He's then affixed them to a canvas or some sort of support. He has made some changes, he admitted, after about 10 years of doing this, he admitted, well, occasionally I thought it needed another tear, or, you know, it didn't quite look right, so I wanted to, you know, put something or take something out of it. But his idea when he started doing this in the very end of the 40s, 1949 really, was the notion of more of collecting objects. Saw himself as a collector rather than a creator. And this is a notion that ultimately goes back to Marcel Duchamp, who ultimately was from Normandy as well, it just occurs to me, of the ready-made, of an object that's taken out of one context and then put into another context that transforms it into a work of art. And so he began being fascinated by the look of these things. And he saw them as anonymous collective objects, not art objects in and of themselves. But these were things that people would have torn for whatever reason, or it would have been weathered. But they got torn over time. And so he pretty much took them as they were and put them in a new context. At first he hesitated signing, and I don't think this work is signed, but then he began to sign them because he said he needed to have people recognize it as an artwork. So now you know the definition of an artwork, sign it and you've got it made, or put a label next to it, either one will work. And also by signing it he felt it would be preserved, besides being recognized, so it would not be destroyed. He referred to this as the lacerated posters or the torn posters. It became of interest to a number of Europeans. There's a work not very often seen in the museum of, it's a sculpture of match, it's a match flap, open match flap by Raymond Ames, who was a colleague of Vielgaille's. And they in fact showed together in the early 50s. And he became, both of them became part of a group called the New Realists in 1960. And they were interested in a new perceptual approach to reality. And it was a very dispersed group. But there were other people. In Italy, there was an artist named Mimmo Rotella who was doing something very similar. In Germany or Austria, Wolf Vostell, who coined the term décollage, was also doing this sort of thing. So it became a kind of interest that was shared by a group of artists who were coming out of World War II, who were living in an era, we're thinking the 50s, late 40s, throughout the 50s, of a kind of reconstruction and rebuilding Also for France, a war in Algeria, a very violent time, and riots in Paris itself. And it, in a way, is a kind of metaphor for all this activity that is sort of tearing at society as it's trying to rebuild itself. There's an exhibition in L.A. right now at L.A. MoCA called Destroy the Picture. And it, if you happen to get out there in the next month or so, it's really a terrific show. And there are a number of works of his in the exhibition and a whole bunch of artists that we don't hear all that much about. Some of them were in the Fontana, for example, were in the Declaring Space show that Michael Opping did a few years ago. But it's a really terrific show, and it makes a fascinating contrast in thinking about this group of artists who were creating works in which they essentially were trying to destroy the idea of art to create a new art because of, again, their experience in World War II and the aftermath. It's exactly the same time as the Abstract Expressionists. And I don't know, for me, I found it put Abstract Expressionism in a very different light, seeing work like this. And there were some Americans included in the show in L.A., including Lee Bontecue, who's still working today. But other artists who, you know, I'd never heard of before. And then artists that are fairly well known, Alberto Burri, an Italian, who does some wonderful distressed works, we might call them, but very materialistically oriented. This phrase, by the way, it's normal, it's Norman, it has a kind of dual meaning, particularly for an artist who's from Normandy. One is, this is actually a slogan advertising butter from Normandy. The other is, it's a kind of idiomatic expression that means, so it goes. You know, my son-in-law is French, and I went to the source, and I think his family's from Normandy originally? Brittany, close enough. it's France. And he said, yeah, it's kind of like in Normandy, they have a hard time deciding. They go back and forth. And, you know, that's normal for them to, you know, so it goes. So anyway, playing off it both in an idiomatic way and then also in terms of advertising itself, which puts it, and this is one of the reasons it sort of fits into the pop gallery in the sense that it deals with popular culture and it deals with popular imagery. I wanted to turn your attention to the Richer painting, which is one of my favorite paintings, which I hope eventually will be in the collection permanently. This is a work that includes, of course, a torn book. So you've got that distressed quality in this particular composition, pitted against this incredibly sleek, absolutely pristine station, a standard station. Like, this is the standard for gas stations. This is the model, the paradigm. And, of course, it was a kind of standard for a lot of stations for this particular company at the time. But it's a wonderful work, I think, in part because for all its recognizability and so forth, it's just totally bizarre. Like a lot of Richer's work is often hanging here is Richer's Jar of Olives Falling, which is also, almost a surrealistic image. But to have these two different spaces juxtaposed here has always fascinated me. And the architectural quality of the rendering, essentially, of the gas station. And then this magazine, which at first you want to say it's floating in air, but then you realize there's a shadow underneath it. So it's actually on the surface, but that doesn't make sense either, because how is that sky really a surface? So it's there. And why is it ripped? And why is it you know, is it a play between the clarity of this and the destructiveness of this? Is that part of it? You know, is it purely coincidental that the magazine says 10 cents and the tax on gas is 10 cents? Or, you know, is he being very much aware of it? I photocopied, I don't know if anyone wants to look or not, but you can actually buy this magazine on eBay if you'd like to. And it's a little hard to read when it's on its side, but there's a wonderful kind of play with language and play with forms in most of Rouchet's work. And in this Western that's ripped in half, it's actually an old magazine. It's from 1946 compared to The Gas Station, which is really more of the 50s into the 60s. But a number of these articles, which are the actual articles that are in the real magazine, play off of cowboy guns. For example, there's an article called Red Rope by Tom Gunn. And then there's an article called, a story called Renegade Rancher by Gunnison Steele. You know, it sounds like a made-up name if there ever was one. Son of a Gunman is the other title. So this idea of playing on guns in the West and Rouchet driving west from Oklahoma out to Los Angeles, it somehow is all of a piece, but it's also so totally at odds with one another at the same time. But he pulls it off, and he pulls it off, I think, really wonderfully well. Pardon me?
Two different cultures.
Two different. Well, and the whole Western movement through cars, actually. Yeah, yeah, it's all there. If you want to just turn around, a couple of things about two other works that are in this gallery. The Maryland, 25 Colored Marylands by Andy Warhol, and from 62, and Mr. Bellamy by Lichtenstein from 1961. Both of these, you may have noticed on the labels, they were purchased from the collection of Vernon Nickel, who lived in Clovis, New Mexico. He just died a couple of years ago. And when I was working on the 110 catalog, these were two of the works I wrote about. And I was curious about Mr. Nickel and how somebody in Clovis, New Mexico would have had these two works, in my provincial way of thinking. That didn't seem possible. And when I found out he was a postal worker, it seemed even more unlikely. Well, in fact, we had a very nice conversation on the phone and then a couple of correspondence through the mail. And he was, in fact, a postal worker, and he had seen Art Forum magazine, seen ads, particularly for the Dwan Gallery in Los Angeles, and he saw both of these that way and bought them for an unbelievably small amount of money for the time. And they accrued in value over the years, obviously. And he continued to buy. And the University of New Mexico has a collection of his work. I haven't seen how many pieces are. I know they have a Joseph Beuys work that he collected as well. But it was such a delight to talk with him and how he had built this collection mainly by looking at reproductions. And then continuing to buy over the years. After he received the 110 catalog, he wrote me a really nice little postcard which had on the front of it images of, an image I should say, of a painting by Andy Warhol of crosses. Warhol did a whole series of cross paintings. And on the back it said, collection of Vernon Nickel. And I thought, wow, he's got that too. But anyway, he thought the catalog looked fabulous. He was, I think he came and visited the museum, and he thought the whole thing was just really wonderful. And he made some comment that he was so glad that his children had found a nice home. So I've really enjoyed getting to know him a little bit at any rate. In the essay that I wrote on the Lichtenstein, I indicated that the source, because so many of the sources for Lichtenstein's works have been identified, that the source for this particular work really had not been identified. Since then, there have been a couple of sources suggested. Both of them revolve around the comic book, comic book, I guess, and comic strip character, Steve Canyon. And there's actually a wonderful website called Deconstructing Lichtenstein. And David Barcelou, who apparently has a huge amount of time on his hands, has looked through, he says, 30,000 comics and comic strips trying to identify various images from Lichtenstein paintings. And he's actually, he came up with the same one I did, so I was sort of pleased by it, because I've been looking for 10 years, not quite as obsessively as his. I don't know. It's close, but it's not exact. And most of Lichtenstein's use of a figure like that would be closer to a particular panel. And the images I've seen